also, I think you can see the stage looks better tonight. When I came last night, I thought I was in a third world country. I don't know about you. I said, wow, this is like going back in time or something. So anyway, just with one SMS this morning, you can see a very amazing transformation. Thanks to Pei Chong and Brother Jerry, who quickly improved the look of the stage. So thanks to them. And I hope you feel a bit more comfortable, because I also asked them to space out the chairs a bit, and hopefully that gives you a bit more air. A very kind member yesterday came to us and said he would like to help sponsor the air conditioning for this hall after he sat there suffering for about an hour and a half, I think. It just goes to show how spoiled we have become as Singaporeans, that taking the heat has become a challenge for us, because we're so used to having air conditioning at home, in the office. And many of us women even have to wear shawls, right? In Singapore, have sweaters and jumpers in the office. There is a market for that in Singapore. It's quite amazing. So yesterday, Ajahn Brahm walked us through a meditation, short session of meditation. And that, I'm sure, has helped many of us to realize that a lot of the suffering comes from our mind, and of course with the senses in our body. And I think it will be a nice way to start again tonight with a short meditation session, because that is really the key to our Buddhist path, our Buddhist practice, although it was kind of lost along the way for many years, and now it's certainly being revived in terms of learning and practicing meditation. But tonight's topic is very interesting. It's making sense of God's ghosts and angels, because many a times whenever things go right, we always think there's an angel looking after us, or a God out there somewhere being kind to us. And I don't know, when things go wrong, what do you blame it on? Usually ourselves or somebody else. But we forget that how come a God or angel has not been kind to us, right? So tonight, Ajahn Brahm is going to address that in terms of making sense of these three aspects of beings that we don't see, but we think we feel. So to those of you who are new to the Buddhist Fellowship, we are a group of English-speaking professionals. We made up a membership. And so if you're not a member yet, we certainly invite you to join. And Ajahn Brahm is our spiritual patron. He's apart from his time away from the monastery, he's otherwise the full-time abbot at the Bodhayana Monastery. And he runs a monk factory there. And a good monk factory as well, because he upholds the Vinaya, which is the code of discipline. And therefore, they don't have possessions apart from their robes and their bag and a few items of need. Which is very inspiring, because for those of us who've seen monks owning cars, flats, animals, whatever they may be, makes us question as to whether the path of the Buddha that he led and talked about still can really exist in this world, in this time and place. So Ajahn Brahm is indeed an inspiration in that regard. And he's been a monk now for 39 years. No, sorry. 36 or 7, yeah. And he's 59 years old, but looking very young. So this reflects the good life of a monk. No money, but no stress. So maybe money gives us stress. So now I'll hand you to Ajahn Brahm. Please put your hands together. Welcome, Ajahn Brahm.
Meditation, first of all. Okay. Especially for this evening, where we're going to be giving a talk on ghosts and other spirits. And I did notice that there's many seats in the back. They're not empty. (Laughter) But I know one thing, that ghosts don't like meditation. So when you meditate, and we tell everyone to meditate, the ghost will go out of here. So if you like to sit quietly, close your eyes, and bring all of your attention into the here and now. And first of all, to relax your own body. Been rushing around all day, rushing to get here. Now you're here, sitting in your seat. See if you can relax all of your legs, your bottom, your back, your arms and your head. Relax to the max. And as you're relaxing, you become aware of the sensations in your body. If there's any sensation which is irritable, which is unpleasant, don't try and get rid of it. Be with it. Give it metta or loving kindness. Say to the irritation, the door of my heart is fully open to you. And when you give kindness to any irritation in the body, you will find it relaxes, it becomes more comfortable, and the irritation, the ache or the pain eases off. Most pain comes from tightness. Relaxing causes the pain to ease, the irritation to lessen, and the body to become more healthy. Being aware of the body is called mindfulness. Being kind to the body adds the ingredient called compassion. Mindfulness and compassion together leads to peace. And just be with your body, relaxing it, easing it, until it feels as comfortable as you can possibly make it. And once the body is relaxed, next we relax our mind, letting go of all the tension caused by carrying the past and the future. You can imagine that you've been carrying two heavy bags, one in your left hand, one in your right hand. And they are so heavy, and you've been carrying them for so long, that your arms ache and your shoulders hurt. The one in your left hand represents your past. All of your memories, good and bad, which is in a bag you carry around with you all the time. The bag in your right hand represents your future, with all of your plans, fears and worries, which you also carry around with you all the time, which is why the mind aches. Now imagine that bag in the left hand representing your past. Imagine lowering that bag to the ground. And when it meets the ground, the weight disappears. Imagine uncurling your fingers from the handle and moving your left arm up until it hangs loosely by your side, relaxing, restoring its strength. You've let go of your past. Now you focus on the bag in your right hand, which represents your future, the fears, the worries, and the hopes, which if we carry around too much makes us hurt. Imagine lowering that bag in your right hand, representing the future, down to the ground. And when it meets the ground, the weight disappears. You move your hand away from the handle until your right arm is hanging loosely by your side, relaxing. You've let go of the future. And by doing this mental exercise, it helps you let go of the real past and the real future, which, when we keep carrying it around, creates this tiredness, this tension, and this lack of ability to rest. You look down at those two bags, the past, the future. It's there for you after the meditation, but you're going to leave it down there for a while to rest in this space between the past and the future, what we call the present moment, just now. Just now. And whatever you're experiencing right now, be kind to it, in the same way you are compassionate to all the feelings in the body. So you relax with the present moment. You open your mind as if you're expanding to accept whatever you're experiencing right now. You are careful not to run off into your future, nor to linger in the past. In meditation, we try to be free from the past and the future for these few minutes. Open the door of your heart to this moment called now. Make peace with the now. If you make peace in this moment, you are creating a future of peace, because now is where your future is being made. Stay in this moment and be kind to whatever you're experiencing now. Like the Buddha, you smile at this moment. It's life as it's happening, and our only duty is to have compassion to this experience in front of us right now. Relaxing with this moment. Embracing it brings up the feeling of peace, where we're not fighting the world, we're resting. And notice that feeling of peace. Notice it grow inside of you as you relax not just the body, but also the mind. Softening, opening, releasing. Not trying to go anywhere or be anything. just being more fully with where you already are. See if you can notice the feeling of contentment, of peace, of stillness begin to grow in your mind like flowers in a garden. Contentment, peace, freedom. How do you feel now? What's it like to be peaceful inside? Now we've come to the end of the meditation, so I'm going to ask you to slowly open your eyes and come back to the world, refreshed, having touched a few moments of peace. Thank you. So now if you'd like to get yourselves comfortable again, and we'll start to talk about ghosts, spirits, angels and gods, and all of those stories. Now, I am not only a Buddhist monk. As many of you know, before I became a monk, I was a scientist, a theoretical physicist. And even when I was at Cambridge, I was also interested in ghosts. While I was a student, I joined 3 clubs. While I was a student. One was the Astronomical Society, because I loved looking at the stars and the heavens. That was one of my hobbies, astronomy. The other society which I joined, the Buddhist Society in Cambridge University. And last year in October, I went to give a talk to them on the 40th anniversary of going up to Cambridge in 1969. 40 years since I first joined that university and joined their Buddhist Society, I met one of the presidents in London, and she said, "Why don't you come and give us a talk? No, you were a committee member 40 years ago." So I had great fun going to the old university. And where I used to sit in the back, listen to other people talk, now I was giving the talk. It was just a wonderful feeling of gratitude. So that was the other society I joined, the Buddhist Society. And the third society which I joined, the Psychic Research Society, which looked at paranormal phenomena, including ghosts. And the head of that society at the time was a man called Dr. Tony Cornell. Again, in October, he was supposed to come round to have lunch with me, but he was too sick. His wife came, Because Tony Cornell, he became the chief, the number one, the top ghost hunter in Britain. Now, this is no joke. If you like to Google his name, Tony Cornell, Cornell as in Cornell University, you will find that he was appointed by the London Psychic Research Society, the oldest society in Europe, which investigated paranormal phenomena. He was the head ghost hunter for years and years and years, and he's a personal friend of mine. So I have contacts with the chief ghost hunters in Britain, and these were scientists just like myself. So these weren't crazy people, you know, people who were a bit funny in the head and imagine things. This was scientific research into the paranormal. And he told me, the last time I saw him a couple of years ago, about 3 or 4 years ago, he said throughout his whole life, now he'd been in houses where there were real ghosts. He said, interestingly, because you cannot be superstitious. One thing which I dislike in religion is being superstitious. He said whenever he investigated any paranormal phenomena, he would always take a professional magician, because the magicians know how to trick people, and he could see whether anyone was tricking you. So first of all, he would check with the magician that no one was trying to fool him, and he would go with cameras, infrared cameras, ultrasounds, you name it. Being a scientist, he had access to all those things. And he said he saw these ghosts. He saw the ghosts, and he had things flying through the air around him. But all the time, he said his greatest frustration, he could never get that photograph. Okay, he could never get that photograph of a real ghost. He could always get a few shady images, but not the perfect photograph. And he said this was very strange. He could see them, other people could see them, things flying through the air. There's one rule about ghosts. They're very camera shy. Not like me. I see a camera and I smile. But ghosts, no, they somehow disappear. But certainly they do exist. And because they do exist, there is certain things to know about them. Now I say they do exist, and the reason as a Buddhist monk I like giving talks about ghosts is not to scare you, but it proves that life does exist after death. That we don't just have one life and that's it. In some religions they think once you die, that's it, nothing left. Or at least, you know, you go to heaven and that's it. But certainly in Buddhism and in science, I'm going to mention this later on, there is solid proof that once you die, that's not the end of things. And ghosts are part of that. But first of all, you don't need to be afraid of ghosts. One thing that Dr. Cornell told me, in the whole history of ghost hunting in Britain, never once did a ghost hurt anybody. He said things went flying through the air around him. He's a personal friend. I trust this guy. But he said it never hit him. It went right past his ear. It went right over his head. But it never hit him. Ghosts can only make you afraid, but they can't harm you at all. Unfortunately, people are so afraid of ghosts, you are like elephants afraid of a mouse. A mouse is a tiny thing, but elephants are afraid of mice. just like human beings. You're powerful, but you're afraid of ghosts who are tiny in their power. So once you know this, when you see a ghost, don't be afraid, because ghosts can be very helpful to you. Here's story number one, a real ghost story, which happened in Perth. Unfortunately, these aren't scary. If you want a scary one, I'll tell you one afterwards. But this is a helpful story. One of our members of our Buddhist society in Perth, he died about 4 or 5 years ago. Okay, I'll tell you his name, because some of you who come on retreat at our Jhana Grove, some of you have been there, you may know his ex-wife, Bianca. This is Bianca's ex-husband. I think Angie would know Bianca and a few others who've been on retreat at Jhana Grove in Perth. Her former husband, he was a builder. Now, not really a builder, like someone who worked for a builder. And many, many years ago, when he was a young man, he was working on a house. He'd already met his partner, Bianca, but they were very poor. She was a school teacher, he worked with a builder. It's not the greatest of jobs, but had enough money to get by. But the most difficult thing is getting enough money to get a mortgage or a deposit on your house. You know what it's like with young people? Trying to get your first apartment or your first house. He was saving and saving, but you know what it costs, and looking after himself and his wife. He could never really get enough for a deposit on a house until a ghost helped him. He was working on an old house, doing some renovations. For those of you who've been to Australia, the old houses were built on small brick pillars or wooden pillars, stumps, and the house was built on top. So there was an undercroft underneath the house. He walked by the undercroft and he heard clearly a man's voice. "Put your hand under here," he heard. There was no one around. He was there by himself. He heard it clearly. It was the sound of a ghost. But not being scared, he put his hand under the house, and there was an old biscuit tin, a metal container which people used to keep biscuits in. He brought it out from under the house where it was hidden. He opened it and it was full of cash. It was where the previous owner had hidden the money to keep it safe from the tax man. And the previous owner had died, and that previous owner saw this young Buddhist and thought, "I want to help this young man get a start in life." And that is how he got the deposit for his first house, because he listened to the ghost. So if ever you hear a ghost, please do not run away. Ask where's the cash first. And if he's got no cash, then you can run away. That is a true story. What ghosts are is when you die. If you want to look at the research on death, you don't have to wait until you die before you find out what happens. Many people have already done it. And you can ask them what happens when you die. Go onto Google. Just type in the three letters N-D-E. N-D-E. It stands for near death experiences. And there's a whole huge amount of information from scientists, from doctors, from professors, not from nutcases. Because that information is recorded about what happened to people who died and came back to tell the tale because of dying from cardiac arrest, accidents on the operating table. And there's also information there on people who can remember their past lives. And not just remember their past lives, but remember what happens in between. I like to tell this story of an NDE, a near-death experience. Whenever I conduct funeral services for Buddhists, because at a funeral service, it's not just paying respect to the person who's passed away, it's understanding exactly what's happened to them. And I tell this story because it's about a person who's not a Buddhist. I don't think he's even a Christian. He's a free thinker. He also happened to be a senator in the Australian federal government. He wrote an article about what happened to him when he was serving in the Australian army during the Vietnam War. He was helping a friend who was wounded, and because he was not thinking of himself, just looking after his fellow soldier, he stepped on a landmine and blew off both of his legs. He was in a wheelchair, and he was the senator in the Australian Parliament you could recognize as the only one in the wheelchair because of that accident during the Vietnam War. But he told what happened when he had his legs blown off. The blinding flash followed by unendurable pain. More pain than anyone can take, but only for a second or two. And the next thing he knew, and I will never forget this senator's words. For those of you who want to check, his name was Graham Edwards. Graham Edwards. The next thing he said was floating above the paddy fields of Vietnam without a care in the world, the most peaceful, blissful, free experience he'd ever known. He died. He'd left his body. And he described it as timeless peace and happiness without any care or worry. It was so enjoyable. Now that's something which everybody who has those experiences relates. Directly after death, it's a very, very pleasant experience. I say that because once you know what it feels like after death, no longer are you afraid of death. You're afraid of dying, the process by which you get to that point, but once you're dead, once you leave the body, it's so much freedom and peace. And I'm sure in this audience, there are a couple of people who will come up afterwards and say, thank you, Ajahn Brahm, that happened to me. That's exactly what it feels like. To give you another, and I'll finish the first anecdote in a few moments. To give you another anecdote, there was a lady being operated in Australia. She also died on the operating table, left her body. She was having such a wonderful time, she didn't want to go back to her body. She could see it on the operating table. The doctors were working on her to try and get her back to life again. And she met this other spirit. And the other spirit told her, you have to go back into your body. And she said, no way. She said, you have to, it's not the time to die. I don't care. I prefer being dead. And they had an argument. In the end, this other spirit literally took hold of her and threw her back into her whole body. And she came alive again. And in the interview, she said, I'll never forgive that spirit for what he did. When I die, I'm going to find that guy and I'm going to scold him. The reason she said that, because it is so pleasant once you're dead. As for this senator in the Federal Parliament of Australia, he said he did not know, he could not understand how long he was out of his body, but a thought came to his mind. The thought which came to his mind was his wife, back in Perth, where I live. His wife had just given birth to his first child, a son. And he thought, it's not right, as a father, I should abandon my wife and child at this time. And with that thought of attachment, he was drawn straight back into his body. And he felt the intolerable pain again. And he blanked out. And the next time he opened his eyes, he was in the field hospital being treated for evacuation to treat his wounds and to start the long journey back. That was his experience, what it was like to die. And it has a lot of important messages. Not only is it pleasant, not only is it you can see and hear, but what brings you back is your attachments to things. Now, what happens with things like ghosts? First of all, they don't disappear straight away when they die. Even good people, they hang around to tie up loose ends. And you don't need to be afraid. If you see the ghost of your mother, your father, or your wife, your child, shortly after their death, they're just coming to say goodbye to, again, just to make sure that everything's all right before they go. Just as you would. If you were called to say, go to New York for business this evening, you'd make sure you say goodbye to your mum, your father, whatever, to say, look, I've got to go to New York, okay. You'd SMS them, you'd call them, you'd contact them first of all. Now that's what happens when people die. They want to make sure that everything's okay. There were two old people staying in an aged person's accommodation in my home city, Perth, Australia. One was a widow, the other one was a widower. They'd had their wife before, their husband, their partners had died, they were by themselves, the kids had gone overseas somewhere, and so they were staying in an old people's home. Because they were staying next to each other, they became friends, even though there was no romance anymore, because they were too old for that. They were just close friends. She would sometimes cook a nice meal for him, and if she needed any handiwork done in her room, he would do it for her. So they were good friends. He died. And because he never left the address or contact details of his family, she arranged a funeral for him. She did everything because she was his friend and he had no one else. But she said he'd always told her that he had a daughter in England somewhere. So after he died, she looked in his room for a telephone number or an address, but there was no record in his room of any way to contact the only living relative which she knew, his daughter in England. So she had to go ahead with the funeral, do everything, and just settle it. She said a few days after the funeral, in her bedroom, in the middle of the night, she was woken up by someone stroking her cheek. She felt it. First of all, she thought it was a burglar. You know, some sex fiend come to rape her. That happens in Australia. So she was really scared. She turned on the bedside lamp. No one was in the room. The door was locked. The window was shut tight. So she thought, I'd imagined it. You know, sometimes in a dream, it can be just like reality. You can imagine things. But then, she saw she had a tissue paper on the table. She folded it up in case she needed to blow her nose in the middle of the night. The tissue paper levitated off the table and fell to the floor. No wind. She realized what was happening. She opened up that tissue paper, and on that tissue paper was a series of numbers. She never wrote those numbers on there. She knew exactly what to do. She picked up her telephone, rang those numbers, and a young woman answered in London. She said, I'm sorry to tell you, your father died a few days ago. It was her friend's daughter. It was the daughter. She realized that her friend who had died realized there was some unfinished business. And that unfinished business was contacting his daughter. He hadn't left a telephone number in his room. So as a ghost, as a spirit, he managed, I'm not sure how they do this, to write those numbers on a piece of paper, on a tissue paper, to wake her up by stroking her very gently, and to make sure that she looked at that tissue paper by levitating it up and allowing it to fall to the floor. Now that's what a ghost usually does. It's kind. It doesn't mean to scare you. It just wants to make you feel happy and at peace so the ghost can go. Another of my close friends, he's an Englishman, and he's one of these people who would never believe anything superstitious. You know these people, they've had it with superstition, they don't want ritual, they just want truth. And he lived just in the same suburb as our city centre in Perth, in a suburb of Nollamara, where I go on every weekend. And he said he was in his house alone. He was a single man. He now got a partner, has moved to Tasmania. Single man in his home, woke up middle of the night. He knew that something was in his room, turned on the light. This was not a dream, turned on the light, fully awake, leant up and saw at the end of his bed his mother. His mother was standing there. He said, as clear as you would see a real person, not some hazy picture, real person. And his mother was standing there smiling at him. His mother lives in Essex in England. He knew that this couldn't be the physical body of his mother. He knew it was his mother's ghost. He said that's the only time he's seen a ghost. And he said he wasn't at all afraid. In fact, he felt so much peace and happiness. He knew this must mean my mother has died. And now there's my mother looking at me, smiling at me.
He felt so much love and peace come from his mother that he felt that in his heart as he looked and smiled at his mother for the last time. He said that lasted for about 3 minutes, not some flash, but continuous sight of his mother smiling at him at the end of the bed. And then his mother simply faded away and vanished into thin air. He was an Englishman. It was the middle of the night. So he would do what any Englishman would do in such a situation. He made himself a cup of tea. That's the response to anything. So he made himself a cup of tea. And as he was drinking the tea, his telephone rang. His sister from London. Pete. That was his name, Peter. Pete, said his sister, I've got some bad news. Yes, said Pete, mother has died. How the hell did you know that? We've only just come back from the hospital. She died a few minutes ago. And then Pete described to his sister how his mother had come to see him before she passed away. It was one of the most beautiful experiences. Now, if your mother died, if your father died, and they may be in the other side of the world, wouldn't you like to see them one last time? To see your mother just smiling at you, showing her love, saying with that smile, with that look, I'm gone. Don't cry. Be happy. That's what I would like to do if I died. To visit people and say, I'm okay. Don't worry about me. That's what his mother did. That's what many ghosts try and do. They care about you. They don't want to scare you. They just want to tell you where the will is. They want to tell you they're okay. There was one. She was Thai Chinese lady in Perth. Her husband was a Chinese. And she did not trust her husband. I don't know what it is with Thai Chinese not trusting their husband. Do you trust your husband? Well, this girl didn't at all. She said, look, I don't even trust my husband to do a good funeral service for me. So, she said, I want to do a deal. The deal is that in her will, she'll give half her property to my Buddhist temple if our Buddhist temple guarantees to pay for her funeral, because she didn't trust her husband. So they had to go to our committee, and the committee said, well, it's a good deal for us. Sure, we'll do that. So she did the will. In return for our Buddhist temple paying for her funeral, that she would give half her property, it was only a small townhouse, to our Buddhist society. She died. We did her funeral service for her. And after she died, her husband, George, you know, we're not people who go and demand money off people who... Just after the funeral service, we didn't go up to George and say, where's the will? Give us the money. No, we waited until he got over the death, waited until he came to us and gave the will. He did come to us and said, I can't find the will. I don't know where it is. And because we're Buddhists, we say, oh, never mind, you'll find it sooner or later. When you find it, give it to us. Weeks went past, and he still didn't give us the will. And then one day, he came to monastery early in the morning with the will. You found it, I said. And he said, take the will quick. He was obviously very perturbed. He said, what happened? I was woken up in the middle of the night, he said, by my ex-wife. George, 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 get the will. You know where it is. George, George, George. He knew where the will was all the time. He was lying to us. He didn't want to do the other's part and give half of the house to the Buddhist society. He was lying and cheating. But his wife knew. She came in the middle of the night. George, 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 give them the will. He was so scared. He said, take the will, take the will, or she'll come back again. So ghosts are very good. If you promise something to the BF and you don't give it, the ghost will come back. Oh, you won't have any sleep at all. So all ghosts do is just to try and help people. Although that sometimes it's the ghosts which need the help. And if it's the ghosts which need the help, all you need to do is just to do some good karma and give it to the ghost. Because the only reason they sometimes get stuck for some type of attachment, but usually most ghosts, you only see them just after they've dead. But the ones who last a long time, they got something wrong with them. Some attachment, some anger which keeps them there for a long time. So all you need to do, spread some loving kindness, do some karma and share the merits, and that will upgrade the ghost, it'll make them happy, so they leave. If that doesn't work, then you call the monks. Because I've already mentioned that human beings are much more powerful than the ghosts. And of all the human beings, the monks, especially the meditating monks, we're incredibly powerful. So ghosts are terrified of monks. Now I mention this because personal experience. First time I saw a group of ghosts in a monastery in Thailand, they ran away from me. And I was quite surprised. And they said, you can see me, see us? I said, yeah. Ah! And they ran away. That's what I found, because monks are powerful. And they're terrified of monks. That's why, if you got a bad ghost in the house, you send the monks, and the ghosts get terrified. Because we've got more power, we can send them away. But we don't want to harm them. So a lot of times, just pacify the ghosts. You know, be kind, be good. You know, you're dead, go off into a new place, get a good rebirth. That's what we normally do. But you don't need to be afraid. Although sometimes the monks have to be very careful when they send ghosts away. I remember talking with the old chief reverend in Brickfields Temple in Kuala Lumpur. He said in a house close by there was a bad ghost who was causing trouble. But they weren't Buddhists, so they got members of other religions to go there first of all. Now I'm saying this not because I'm pushing Buddhism, but this is actually quite true and well known. Buddhist monks are the most powerful ghostbusters. If the other religions don't work, the Buddhists usually get there. You know, we've got the goods on the ghosts. So, all the other religions went there. And lastly, they asked the chief reverend, Dr. K. Sri Dhammananda. So he went there, did the chanting, got rid of the ghost. Next day, the neighbor came to complain. The ghost had just moved next door. So he had to go round to all the houses to make sure the ghost actually moved from the whole neighborhood. So you've got to be careful. If you come and have some chanting done, make sure the ghost doesn't just move to the next apartment. So it actually works. We can do that and get rid of the ghost. But it's just out of kindness to free you from them. But you don't need to be afraid. Especially when someone has died, if they come to see you, it's usually to say goodbye. Or sometimes to help you. So when someone has died and you miss them, let the ghost come. They may have some beautiful news for you, and where the money is kept, or the whatever. Listen to them. Don't run away. Don't be afraid. They can't harm you. Now, I keep mentioning that because I'm trying to get rid of people's fear of ghosts. You don't need to be afraid at all. Now, that's just ghosts. Now, we have other beings, like the gods, angels. Angels also exist, but you have a hard time to see them. They're very, very, very rare, much more rare than ghosts. And the reason why they're rare is they usually only help really good people, people with very high intentions. They're the ones who angels help. There's an old story in the Thai forest tradition of a monk called Lumpo Chop. He was in Burma during the Second World War. He was meditating there. In those days, there were no barriers. You could go from country to country without a passport. It didn't matter. There was a much more freedom. So he was meditating in Burma, but the Second World War came. Thailand capitulated to the Japanese, and so Thailand was looked upon as an enemy of the British. And the British regarded Thai monks as spies, so they actually killed those monks. I'm very embarrassed about my ancestors. So now I'm paying off the debt of my ancestors by killing Buddhist monks, by being a monk myself. But they actually killed Buddhist monks, thinking they were spies. And so they told this monk, "You better be careful. In fact, you better leave Burma. If the British soldiers come, they'll interrogate you, they probably will kill you." And they said, "You can't leave by the main route, because the soldiers will be on that route. You have to go via the jungle, by the forest paths." And being a forest monk, he said, "Yes." But they said, "Look, there are no villages on the way for days. You have to be fit and healthy, otherwise you won't make it." But he had a choice: dying by a bullet from the British, or dying on the journey, or maybe surviving. It was no real choice, so he took the journey. Now, I've been in those areas close to the Burmese border. These are mountains. They're steep. It's not like flat roads like in Singapore. These are really hard walking. Day after day after day, and he hadn't eaten anything. You can't take supplies as a monk. Eat your meal of the day and that's it. And he was getting to the point of exhaustion, thinking he wouldn't make it. Deep in the jungle, still a few days away from civilization. And he thought, "I'm not going to make it." But he remembered stories about the gods, the angels, what we call in Buddhism devas. And he said, "If there are devas, if this is true, even as a monk, you don't just believe. You try it out, test it, see if it's true. If there are devas, they should help a monk like me. I keep my Vinaya rules. I'm a meditator. I'm a good monk. Surely they should help someone like me." He made that determination. About 5 or 10 minutes later, he rounded a bend in the path. This was in the middle of the jungle. He hadn't seen a village for days. There was a man standing on the path. And there were many strange things about this. First, the man was well dressed, in Bangkok dress. Even today, you don't see that in the north. You don't see that in the jungle. If there are any people in the jungle, they wear rags. This man was well dressed. Number two, he had one of these tiffin cans. You may remember them in Singapore 20, 30 years ago. Little trays, one upon the other, with food which you take to work with you, especially in the fields. He had tipping cans. And when the monk walked past, as a monk you're not allowed to ask for anything, even if you're starving. The donor has to invite you first of all. And this donor invited the monk, please accept some food. In Thai, Nimon Krap. He opened his bowl, and this man by the side of the road put hot, delicious food into the monk's bowl. Now, I have been in those jungles. In those jungles, if you get food, it is not white rice. It's usually potatoes, because they don't have rice. It's usually things like monkey hands. No, jungle food, that's all they have. This was Bangkok delicious food. Hot. He thought, how did that man know I was coming? Where did this hot food come from? What's he doing here in this jungle? So he asked this man, where do you come from? And this man never answered. He never spoke. He just with his finger pointed upwards. It was a deva. There's no other explanation. That monk ate that food. He completed his journey another 2 or 3 days before he came to the village. There was a god, a deva, helping a good monk survive by making sure he had some food. That was one of the stories in our tradition. So, when I was a young monk, when I was wandering in the jungles, this was in the Phupan Mountains. Well, how many years ago? 30 something years ago. When it wasn't developed, these days there's villages everywhere. I was walking and walking. I had food that morning, but I'd run out of water. I was thirsty, exhausted. Later I actually got heat stroke in those mountains. I came... Very good. See? Deva. Where do you come from? So, I got to a ridge in the mountains. In the valley below, I saw there was a small settlement, about 4 or 5 houses. Now, I was really thirsty. I hadn't drunk for a long while. I was hot. I was tired, and I thought, as I saw that village, I know that in one of those houses they'd have the old general store, which sold cigarettes, matches, kerosene, and also Pepsi Cola. And I remembered the story of Lumpur Chaw. I made my own resolution. I said, I am a good monk. I keep the Vinaya. I'm a meditator. And look, I really am thirsty. I really need some water. Otherwise, I might not make it. I said, if there are devas, and I made this clear resolution, if there are gods, please give me a Pepsi. And it was a clear determination. I needed it. I was a good monk. I remember that story. Let's see if devas exist. And I walked mindfully into that small village. My eyes down, 2 meters in front, not looking to the left or the right, walking slowly, not stopping. out of the corner of my eye, I realized I just passed that little general store, and no one had stopped. No one had asked me to receive anything. And I thought, for 1 minute, Devas don't exist. They're not helping me. And when I thought that, and I was walking past, then I heard someone running up behind me. Nimon Krupp, they said. The words for making an invitation. I turned around, and there was a boy with an open Pepsi Cola to offer me. That could have been coincidence. But then another man came with another bottle of Pepsi Cola. And another, and another, and another, and another, and another, and another, and another. 9 bottles of Pepsi Cola. And I sat down on a seat, and I put those 9 bottles in a row in front of me. And I thought, these devas, these gods, they have sense of humor. They want to make sure that I do believe there are such things as devas. 1, I'd have put away as a coincidence. 9, that's no coincidence. And ask any Thai people here, what is the lucky number in Thailand? 9. 9 is prosperity, forward. Just like if I did that in Singapore, in China, I'd get 8 bottles of Pepsi. Thailand, 9. And I realized, yes, that devas do exist, and they will help you as long as you are a good person. If you want a bottle of whiskey, no way. Something which you need, yes, they will help. And so as a monk, sometimes I do call upon those heavenly beings, but only in times of great necessity. And perhaps the one time which I called on them and they really helped out was in 2003. In 2003, we were celebrating our 30th anniversary of our Buddhist Society of Western Australia. At that time, we built up our organization, but like Buddhism in Singapore, we'd kept to ourselves. Now was the time to come out and show Western Australia how united we were and how strong we were. We were proud of being Buddhists. So we decided to hold a big celebration on Waisak 2003 on the full moon day, which happened to be a Sunday. Everything came together. We hired the central field in Perth, a place called Supreme Court Gardens. We hired it from the council for the day. We were going to set up tents, marquees, Buddha statues. We invited the Premier of Western Australia, the head politician in the state, who became a close friend, Dr. Jeff Gallup. We invited ministers, politicians, ambassadors, the Thai ambassador was there, and the TV to come to our first big celebration, our 30th anniversary, Waisak, in the middle of the city, everyone invited, on a Sunday, 2003. When I woke up in the morning, it was pouring with rain. Not just ordinary rain, pouring with rain. We rang up the meteorological office. They said it was going to get worse. A huge storm was coming from the Indian Ocean, and it was due to cross onto the land about 7 p.m. in the evening, when we were going to hold our ceremony. The monks asked me, shall we carry on? And I said, of course we will carry on. Before I left in the car to go to the field, to work hard with everybody else, to set up everything, I went to my room and I did the strongest chanting I've ever done, telling those devas, look, you better help out. I really made it quite tough to them, I'm being honest with you. We went in that bus, it got worse and worse and worse. Because the premier was coming, three times that day I got a call from the premier's office. Are you cancelling? No. A few hours later, we've got the report, it's going to go worse. Are you cancelling? No. The next time, look, are you sure you're going to go ahead? Yes. Tell the premier we're going ahead with the ceremony. One of our monks came up to me, took me aside, and said, look, Ajahn Brahm, I'm your disciple. You're a really good monk. But sometimes even good monks are stupid. He said, you can't go ahead. There's a storm coming. And I said, look, we're going ahead. You know, as a leader, sometimes you have to be stubborn. That's what leadership is. Leading people where they don't want to go. Another disciple came up to me. He said, look, I was a seaman. I had spent all my life on the oceans. I'm now retired. I'm a Buddhist. I know, look, the barometer is going down. This is a storm coming. I know this. This is my whole life. You have to cancel. No. I was by myself. Basically, everyone else wanted to cancel. No. One, I was so proud of my disciples for having faith, and especially at this particular time, the Thai disciples. They were out putting flowers around the Buddha statue. They were soaked to the skin. And they carried on. They were dripping wet. All their clothes, their hair was a total mess. But they had such faith, they just carried on. 1 hour before the ceremony, rain stopped. Half an hour before the ceremony, I will never forget this moment. I was in the tent, helping arrange the chairs. And one of the disciples, a Burmese girl, came running in, crying, Ajahn Brahm, you have to come out, you have to come out. I thought that something terrible had happened. There'd been an accident, someone had been injured or something. And I ran out. No one had been injured. She pointed to the sky. The clouds had parted. And there was the full moon of Vaisak, shining brilliantly. She was crying. The moon was out. We did that ceremony. There was a cameraman there. No, a camera girl. No, sorry, a cameraman, but the reporter was a girl. And she kept on saying, this is weird. This is weird. This is weird. She realized what was going on. We did that ceremony. It rained very slightly for about a minute. And then it dried off. Just like spattering of holy water. The moon was out all the time. And after the ceremony was finished, the sky closed, rain came down, that field was flooded. In all the years I've lived in Perth, that's the only day that field was flooded under 2 or 3 inches of water. The freeway was flooded and closed. That's the only, actually it was flooded a couple of years ago when a water pipe burst. That's the only time I've known it flooded because of rain. A lot of people never came. And I asked them the next day, where were you? And they said, you performed the ceremony? I said, yes. It was dry. Impossible, they said. To the east, the west, the north and south, no joke, trees were coming down. A huge storm came. But in the center of Perth, around our ceremony, not only was it dry, but the clouds opened up and you could see that moon. The Thai ambassador was there, Suchitra. She got a lot of faith when she saw what had happened. She realized there's something strange going on here. Even the Australian company which loaned us the tents and the chairs, the hire firm, they sent an email which was forwarded on to me. And the email read, "We've never heard of this Ajahn Brahm before, but can you please ask him who's going to win the horse racing today? This guy's got powers." I've kept that email, it's in my room. That was when we stopped the storm. And now sometimes you can do a ceremony and you think, yeah, it's a nice day. But this was special. It was the middle of one of the biggest storms and we stopped it. Just in this area, east, west, north and south, it was raining hard and trees were coming down. People didn't believe we'd done the ceremony, but we did. It was there and people came. Now that is what happens when you're doing something really inspiring and good. Those devas do exist and they can help you, but only if you're doing something really, really big and inspiring. Then they can come to your assistance. It does work. It does happen. And I've seen that many times, and there's other stories as well. But I think I'm going on a bit long now. So, other stories, like the story of the Deva who opened doors in Wat Bawon Temple in Thailand to allow a monk to ordain. Devas who stop fires. Devas who help. They're there. And what it shows is, yes, there is life after death. All these things which you read about in those Buddhist texts, you know, I never believed in those things until you see them yourself. There are ghosts, there are devas, there are people being reincarnated. This is what happens. If you don't believe me, you will when you die. Thank you. Okay, I can go on for hours about this, but nevertheless, any questions or comments about ghosts, devas, gods and spirits? Sorry?
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for the very educational, informative talk. So hopefully many of you no longer fear ghosts and have a better understanding of devas and angels, or gods and angels. Just to share with you a story, if you go up to our Buddhist Fellowship Center, which is on the second floor in the building next door to this, you will see our sculpture. And during the pouring ceremony, where the liquid bronze was being poured into the